You know the feeling when your mate's golf ball flies past yours? Or when you're on the green in regulation, but he holds it from the bunker? At Drummond Golf, we get it. That's why we have our lowest price guarantee. As Australia's biggest, you can count on our massive buying power for the lowest prices in golf. But if you do happen to find a lower advertised price, we'll beat it. The Drummond Golf Lowest Price Guarantee. Unbeatable. Conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to episode 93 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's fortnightly attempt to answer that eternal question, what draws people so strongly to this game? Now let's start this episode with a question. What are the similarities between driving a race car at more than 250 kilometres an hour and trying to find a narrow fairway off the tee at a crucial time in a professional golf tournament? The answer, of course, is nothing. Which begs the next question. How does one person become good enough at both to call each his profession? And the answer to that is what we're going to explore today. Thomas Mesra's life story is as fascinating as his professional one. Born in what was then called Czechoslovakia, he showed promise as a downhill skier as a teenager and dreamt of going to the Olympics. But at some point in his life, cars took centre stage. And after eventually escaping the communist regime, he found his place in motor racing in Europe. It was around this time a friend introduced him to golf, a game he admits he was hopeless at first. But he caught the bug and he was hooked. Fast forward some 30 years to a hugely successful racing career, one that included being a teammate of the legendary Peter Brock in capturing Australia's most prestigious production car race at the Bathurst 1000, and Mesra changed course. On a whim, he entered the Legends 2 Q School in 2011 and got his card. And for the 12 years since, he's had the great privilege of calling himself a professional golfer. It's a genuinely intriguing tale and quite the journey, and one I hope that you enjoy listening to as much as I did. Thomas Mesra, I think you might be our first multi-sport guest on The Thing About Golf, so thank you for taking some time. We do really appreciate it. Let's start right at our jumping off point. What is the thing about golf for Thomas Mesra?
It's something I discovered, I suppose, in my later stage. And I was 30 years old and purely by accident. And, from the first day, I tried a game. I never forget that. I was playing in England. We went on public course and, heck around for about 6 hours, and 150 shots later, about 10 lost balls, we finish, and I got hooked on it from that day.
So those wasted years is the first thing you think, isn't it?
Well, I didn't think about it back then, but when you sort of get a little bit better and then you think, I wish I would have started a little earlier, because same as anything, that's why we go to school when we're young, because we learn, sponge, we take everything in. I learned to play tennis as a kid, and I learned to ski, snow ski as a kid. And I was pretty good at it.
You're underselling yourself there, aren't you, by saying you learnt to ski and learnt to play tennis. Yeah. You were national standard in Czechoslovakia, which I can imagine wouldn't have been easy.
I think I was about 15 or 16. I came second in a Czech championship in a slalom, which was pretty good, and my dream was sort of to make it to Olympics. Yeah, that's same as any sportsman in those days. Yeah. The Olympics is the pinnacle. Doesn't matter if it's the swimmers in Australia or skiers in Czechoslovakia back then. And
it's why they get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to the pool, isn't it? That's no fun. But if it can get you to the Olympics, it's worth it.
Any sport to make it to some reasonable level, then you got to put in, and it's a hard work. And lots of people just see the end product. But
We'll come to that. Some of the lessons you might have learned about professional golf. Most of our listeners, some will be familiar with you from the Legends Tour, the Seniors Tour here in Australia, but many more will find your name familiar from motor racing.
Oh, yeah, of course. Like I was reasonably good. You know, I could make a living out of it. And
won Bathurst.
I won Bathurst in Jesus, coming to about 35 1988. Yeah,
the bicentennial.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, yeah.
And you drove actually across the. You took the checkered flag, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I did. Yeah,
that's
yeah,
a big deal. Yeah.
Well,
I think.
You know, I was driving with Tony Longhurst. It's not a Queenslander here from Gold Coast, it was Tony's team, Tony and Frank Gardner team, and they never thought the car would last that long. then Tony just made a stint that I did the last stint because he thought the car sort of would shit itself by then, or we hang it on a wall or something like that. But we sort of kept going, and then at the end. I had to jump in it for the last, 30 laps or something. And I remember Frank Gardner back then, when I was climbing into a car, he said, "Listen, pal, keep it on a track. You hang it on a wall, I'll kick your ass all the way back to England." I was living in England those days. And it sort of came together. And it was great. And I never think big deal. Yeah, because I didn't grow up in Australia.
Is there an awareness of the Bathurst 1000 outside Australia, or is it really available?
Back then, it started to get a bit noticed in Europe, because previous year they had that, was it a World Touring Car Championship in there in 87?
Funny period, wasn't there?
That sort of, got Bathurst a bit more known in Europe, but for me, it was another race.
Well, you were at the time probably what we might consider a journeyman golf pro now, weren't you? You were going to all corners of the globe to race cars to make a living. Have I got that?
Yeah. My story, I came to Australia in 1979 and started racing in here, and did reasonably well in the junior categories, and that sort of earned me the ticket to go to race in England with a little bit of backing from here. And then I raced there. I went there for what they call the Race of Champions, because in a junior category, which was Formula Ford, the Ford Motor Company put actually big money up. Mm-hmm. And the champions of that category from all over the world, they were invited to go to England.
Oh, big deal.
Yeah. Then from, Brazil and US and Canada and all that, and all the bloody countries, Africa, and unbelievable, 26 cars on the grid, and
No protection. If you flipped it, that's it. You'd just be cut in half.
Then
you can't imagine them allowing it in this day and age, can you?
It's safer than you think, but it doesn't look it. Yeah, but I went there to do one race, and I did reasonable, and then kind of got noticed. End up staying there for 5 years, and while I was in there, then I came back to drive in Bathurst with Tony, after the race, I
back on a plane, and
yeah, Monday. I had some testing on Wednesday, after the race in here. Then for me, it wasn't a sort of a big deal back then, but. But now it is, because everyone sort of associates me. Oh yeah, he won Bathurst. He must be very good. Used to be. But
in fairness, you must be. I know that you're not one to beat your own chest, but that's not a small achievement. Is it, particularly in a car that wasn't expected to win? That's a long race. It's an endurance test of the car and the drivers and the team that looks after it to nurse. They used to talk constantly on the company about nursing the car.
Nursing the
cars then weren't like what they are now, were they? Huge, heavy things, chew through tires, brakes that probably weren't good enough for the weight of the car and the speed that they were. You really had to drive them.
It was a little bit more to it. And also those days you had different classes there as well. Like you had 55 cars on a grid.
Little ones in the way.
Yeah.
Little cortinas
not that old, mate. Then, like the Toyota Corollas and a little BMW M3s and all those things. And they were sort of strong in one part of the track, but not that strong in the other part of the track. You come across those things at the wrong spot, you know, cost you the time. And that, like, you had to sort of think ahead a little bit just to make sure you can go through all these slower cars without minimum loss of time and without taking the risks. Then, it's sort of more to it than just you know, pushing on the pedals and turning the wheel.
Two turns and a swish, Arnold.
Yeah.
Am I drawing too long a bow to say there's some correlation between that driving and golf of the time, which would have been played with persimmon clubs, ballada balls, and blade irons?
I wouldn't know. I can't.
You never use that equipment?
I can't go into it because I never bloody hit the ball with those things. And for me, it's hard enough to hit the ball with it. With these, what they call easy clubs to hit in. Yeah, hit with. But I wouldn't think there's, you know, not much between motor racing and golf. Like, you know, you make a mistake in motor racing, you know, it hurts.
It's not a bogey or a double.
Yeah. In golf, you just drop another ball. Yeah. it's easier. It's easier.
I want to come back to golf in a moment, but I do want to get some of your backstory, which I wasn't aware of. Most people who have an understanding of motor racing will be, but an extraordinary tale. Growing up in Czechoslovakia, an Eastern Bloc communist country at the time, which was not a particularly nice place to live in many ways, and you escaped, you fled from there. How old were you? And tell us a bit about that, because that's not an easy decision to make, I would imagine.
Well, it was easy for me those days because I was just about 20 and
Young enough to have no idea what
you were doing. Like you think, everything's easy and you look back at those things, you know, what you did when you were young and you said, Jesus, you were very stupid, you know, doing things like that. But at those days, like I can tell you I was absolutely mad about cars and I wanted to race cars.
Where did that come from, Thomas? In Czechoslovakia?
I had no idea. Like it was a kind of a dream, you know.
Was car racing big in Czechoslovakia? Was it on
not
TV?
Really,
or
not
is there
really,
a culture
but
of car
we
racing?
We got at one stage, we got some Formula One races on TV,
right?
Like in the early mid 70s, something like that, but even before that, I'm always trying to get the magazines and the books about Formula One and about car racing. And
Was it always racing, or were you interested in mechanics?
No, racing.
Just
it was
racing.
Just
cars
racing.
Up. Didn't want to strip down carburetors.
I didn't want to do
that.
No. I was forced to do it then later. I just want to do racing. And it was like a little childhood dream. And my dad always thought I'm a bloody idiot, you know, like, you cannot do it, you know, it's for rich people and all that. And then, but I have to say that I did anything I could trying to get to a point. Like, I wanted to go to Formula One, but, you know, I never did it. I failed at that. But I made it sort of far enough, you know, for many years, you know, making a reasonable living out of it. I never got rich, but made a reasonable living out of it. And made lots of friends. And
live here on the Gold Coast. And, so you're rich in many ways.
Yeah.
Life's turned out okay, I guess.
It's sort of, and even these days, you know, when I stopped racing, I work for Porsche to run the driving school. And that's one thing I probably never would have done if I didn't do my racing. Then sort of indirectly, you know, still the racing helped me to do things in the older age when I stopped racing, and it's sort of a knockoff from that.
As you would now know, having been, I think it's nearly 10 years you've been playing on the Legends Tour now, 2011?
12 years.
12 years, 2011 12 qualified. Years. For,
yeah.
We'll come back to that. In golf, as you would now know, there are some players who are naturally more gifted at an early age and others who have less natural talent but work really hard. Is car racing similar?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But in a car racing, unfortunately, you know, it's a rich man's sport. Like more money you have,
most money
more wins. Opportunity you get. And there are lots of kids from a rich families, and it's hard to compete against them if they're very good. But luckily, like most of them, not that good. You know, they
haven't earned their place.
Yeah. But like when you got someone that's good and's got money, then they go a long way. Yeah, and it's
like having talent and a work ethic. It's like having Tiger Woods, all the talent absolutely. And works harder than everybody else. You can't beat him. He's too good.
Absolutely, yeah.
I know in the MotoGP, the motorbikes, don't ask me how I know this, but quite a lot of those riders will actually buy a seat.
Yeah, same.
Is it the same in motor racing?
Yeah. Absolutely, same. Like it was crazy. Like even my early days when I went to England I was turning up at the race meetings and just when someone got sick or thing like that, and I'll jump in the car I drove and I had that one opportunity and I had to get most out of it. And usually I did. And that led into other things. And because I never had the backing behind me, I was lucky enough to end up driving for the people or for the factory teams. You know, they had the backing and,
that's right.
But, obviously I was reasonable to be in a frame that they come and ask you to drive for them. Yeah.
There's something about that no choice, is that you don't have an option. You just need to perform well in this race. You need to make this cut.
Yeah.
It brings out something
absolutely.
In some people, doesn't it? If you're wired that way, you'll play your best and perform
under
that.
You know, you get one opportunity and you need to make most out of it. Yeah. And if you don't, you know, then you don't know if another opportunity will come. But like if you can pay your way in, you get an opportunity after opportunity.
That's right.
It's happening.
Keep racing. It doesn't really matter.
But that, you know, works against those kids as well because they're not hungry enough.
No.
You know, they're not hungry enough, you know, to succeed.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. We skipped over some fairly, I would imagine, trying times from leaving Czechoslovakia to starting racing. Tell us about some of those and how you think they may have helped to shape you as a person and competitor. I can't help but think we see this with Lee Trevino as a prime example. You know, a really difficult childhood, no money, very limited opportunity, but determined because of that more so, a bit like what we were just talking about. Do you think having left Czechoslovakia and the stress of that and what was involved in that helps to shape and harden the competitor in some way?
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know. But like, it was, you know, it was pretty easy for me. But for other people, they're looking at me. They thought I was doing it hard, yeah. Because like, in Czechoslovakia, I couldn't do it. No matter what you couldn't do it. In here, I got to Sydney. I got 3 jobs, and I worked my ass off.
And never I thought save twice up, about it, I'm sure. Never gave it a second thought.
And I saved up enough money to buy a race car and go racing.
Wow.
It's something I couldn't do in Czechoslovakia. It was easy.
Compared to
but lots of people thought, oh, Jesus, that's hard because, like, I never worry about where I'm going to live and all that, you know, like all the money I make, I'll save up and put in a race car.
Live in a shoebox so that you can buy yourself
a race car. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's sort of, you know, I could say the hard work sort of worked out for me, and I sort of land on the way to work on the car and all that, and it sort of worked for me. And I don't know if it made me any tougher or something like that. And I probably wasn't tough enough on a racetrack, you know, like
How are you tough on a racetrack?
I never punted people off really and pushed them off the track and things like that. I tried to be reasonably fair, you know.
You then need to lots do of that to succeed.
Oh, mate, of course, yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah. Like the best blokes in a sport, right. You know, Michael Schumachers and all those, you know, like they got in trouble for running people off the road and Ayrton Senna and all that, you know. Then. But that was different league, different level. But to succeed, you know, you need to have a fair bit of you know what, in you.
Yeah. Mongrel, we might call it here.
Yeah, mongrel. Yeah, some mongrel. Yeah, I couldn't think of that word.
I know the one you're
thinking about
of.
A C word, yes, you know. Yeah.
Good tell. I'm glad we avoided that.
Yeah.
Before you left Czechoslovakia, and you did touch on this, skiing at a national level would have been
possible. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I was reasonable because I was when I got to age of 18, it was two ways for a kids of that age. You either go to army or you go to university. And I could do both. Yeah, I was good enough skier. I could go to army and ski in the army, or to go to university and ski for a university team.
It's a privilege because of your time.
Yeah. It was, and I had like three offers from different universities to go and join their team and ski for them. And
was it a hard decision not to pursue that in that case? Because I can't imagine that you just picked that up easily. There must have been a lot of work and effort going into getting that good at skiing. Was there any second guessing about leaving that behind?
Oh, not really, no. Right. No, because my mind was set, like a car racing. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, quite remarkable. There would have been people in the skiing community, I imagine, in Czechoslovakia, who thought you were crazy.
Oh, I don't know about that, but it's like for a kind of a future, regardless, you know, it's probably was better off, you know, to get out of there. And and my dad, he always sort of said, you know, it's not much future in here. And he definitely wasn't against it when I told him, like, I'm bloody not coming back, you know, I'm gone.
I imagine would have caused some trouble for him.
It was going through the tough times. Yeah. Through the tough times, with the secret police arriving and taking him for a questioning and all this bloody crap. And it was a bit tough. It was a bit tough for him there. Yeah.
There will be listeners thinking we've lifted this from a movie plot. that if you grow up in Australia, you can't imagine these things happening. It's unimaginable, but they did, didn't they? They really did.
I tell you, it was, my wife, she's not Australian, but, you know, from England, but grew up in Australia. And
she's not like, Australian. Like, born in England, not Australian.
Yeah, but she speaks like us, speaks like me. And, she couldn't believe, you know, the things I was telling her. Like, it was hard to sort of, you know, to take in. And she asked me why, you know, like, and it was hard to explain. You know, like, I remember when I took her back there, the end of communism, you know, like, there was the end of communism in 89. And we were living in England back then. Then we went there for Christmas. And even then, she couldn't believe it when she saw him there.
Because the West didn't know, did we? We didn't know what was happening on the other side. When those stories came out, and remarkable.
Different world.
Literally a different world. Different totally different. World. And a different life experience. Yeah. A friend of mine married a Polish girl who lived in Australia here for many years with him, but always had a sense of paranoia about things. It never left her. Worried that somebody would be listening to phone calls. And we would think, what are you worried? Nobody's going to listen to your phone calls. But she had grown up in a place where people would listen to your phone calls. It was real. For her, she never.
But you couldn't say the things you think.
Yeah.
You know, it was you could get yourself in trouble and your career would have been bloody. You know, like I tell you about my dad. You know, my dad, he was always like anti-communist. Yeah, because as you know, like before, even the 3 years after the Second World War, like the Czechoslovakia, it was like a Western world.
A wonderful, proud nation with a beautiful history and architecture.
And Dad's uncle, he had a huge farm. And, that farm got taken away from him. You know, when the communists arrived in 1948, 3 years after the end of the war, you know, the farm got confiscated. They just, now this belongs to us and you can work for us in here. They talked to his, you know.
It's unthinkable even now, isn't it?
You know, like it's...
What would you say in those circumstances?
And Dad, you know, always because of that. Then that was a little bit, you know, like a anti-communist. And in 1968, in the early of 1968, like the kind of, you know, government was turning around in Czechoslovakia. There was an organization that my dad went to one meeting.
Right.
One meeting. Yeah. And it was the anti-communist organization. And he put a signature there, signed in, and went to one meeting. And that was haunted him for the rest of his life.
Wow.
Yeah. For the rest of his life until, you know, over 20 years.
For having,
you know, just because he went to that meeting, yeah. And was classed as an anti-communist. They took his passport away. My dad didn't have a passport.
Goodness me.
He couldn't go even to bloody Poland.
It takes great courage, doesn't it, under circumstances like that to be a part of? Because there was always in the Eastern Bloc country that there were people who did speak out and agitate for change. That took great courage to do that.
Yeah.
Enormous
courage. Yeah. But, you know, they knew how to deal with those people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, although in hindsight you wonder, ultimately – the system failed, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had
for
to
for all of those reasons.
But we never thought it would fail.
No, of course. When you're living in it, I could imagine.
I never even thought, like, it was crazy because, like, I was, as I told you, I was in England from 86 till 90. I was in England. While I was there, my mom got quite ill and I wanted to come and see her. I went to a Czech embassy in London. And I said, well, this is the situation. What do I need to do, like, to go back there? And it was a huge process. Like, you know, you need to ask for a pardon. You need to cancel your Czech citizenship. You know, you need to apply then for visa. And if you do all this, well, it's no guarantee. Right. We still give you the visas. You know, then it was a huge process. Then I had to pay. Oh, then you had to pay for all the education. Right. You had to pay for all your education the country gave you.
Right.
Yeah? Then in England, I paid about, I don't know, £2,000 or something for my education. 2 months after I paid, it was the end of communism. I didn't have to do that. I never got the money back.
it's like the house you don't buy, Thomas. You know, the house you were in, it was $6,000 and now it just sold for $8 million and you could have bought it, but you didn't. It's like that.
Yeah.
Were you worried about that? Were you nervous about going back under those circumstances?
I was kind of a bit nervous going to a Czech embassy there, you know. You know, it was sort of, I had to do it, you know. I had to go and see my mom. But then at the end, like even before then, we managed to meet in Berlin. I went to West Berlin, they went to East Berlin, and we met Checkpoint Charlie, just, you know. Then,
That's heartbreaking, isn't it?
It's two, you know, two different worlds back then.
Yes.
It was two completely different worlds.
We'll come to the golf in a minute, promise. But
well, it's not much talk about golf.
No, I'm sure there wasn't much golf in Czechoslovakia at the time. But I wonder, Thomas, in the same way that you, when you're living in that circumstance, can't ever see that it's going to fail or change.
Oh.
We take for granted, do we not, in places like Australia, that it will always be like this and that it can't be taken away from us. And that's it. There's a danger there, isn't there?
Well, I tell you, the people whinging and carrying on in here, but like it's, you don't know how lucky the people are here. Yeah, they don't, you know.
No,
problem is the people don't appreciate it sometimes. No. Yeah.
I know every time I've been overseas, which hasn't been often, but I distinctly remember coming back from a trip to Egypt and on the plane back saying to myself, I will never complain about anything in Australia ever again. And a week later, I found myself complaining because I was in North Sydney or Crozes and there wasn't a rubbish bin for me to throw my rubbish in. And, you know, and you catch yourself. The more entitled, the more you have, the more entitled you feel.
Correct. Yeah.
And you don't appreciate what you do have. And there's dangers in that.
At Drummond Golf, we understand your passion.
Nice roll.
And that's because every Drummond Golf store is owned and run by a local who loves the game as much as you do.
Yeah, it's come off the face really well.
Someone who knows where you play and what you need.
Oh yeah, looking good.
With Australia's biggest range and expert knowledge.
Great. Now let's try that putter with this grip.
So if you want to improve your game, see your local expert at Drummond Golf.
let's come to the golf. So the age of 30, you're racing cars in England, and somehow you end up playing golf. Tell us how that came to be, because the two sports, one wouldn't assume from the outside that most racing car drivers would have much interest in going to play golf, but we must be wrong about that.
As I said, that one game I had there, and I got hooked, and then every spare time ever since, you know, like over there, I went to play golf, and I really I got hooked on it, and I enjoyed it. Then I started follow it on TV as well and watching it. Like those days, like it was the days of Seve Ballesteros and Nick Faldo and Norman, and it was Norman, and it was just great to, you know, watch them there on TV
and
suddenly I start to learn a little bit about golf.
Now you think, what have I done? Why all of this?
Like, the people don't realize the feeling you connect in the middle of the club and that ball goes 200 meters or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, you know, like, that sort of things brings you back.
And people who don't play golf, who've never played golf, can't appreciate that. And unless you go to the golf and watch professional golfers play, you can't appreciate what they do. To stand behind Adam Scott, which I remember doing a couple of years ago on the ninth tee at the Australian, and watch him hit a 3-wood that was just a thing of beauty. They should have hung it in the loo. Just this extraordinary ball hit low and you could hear it fizz, and then it raised up and then it just turned right to left maybe 3 or 4 yards and came down and released in the fair. Amazing to watch, but you can't get that on TV. On TV, it just looks like a player swings a club and then he goes down, hits it from somewhere.
Yeah, like it's same as, you know, motor racing.
Yeah.
You know, the TV doesn't do it justice. You watch Bathurst on TV, it doesn't do it justice. The inclination, how high, you know, uphill and downhill and all that. Like, same with golf. Yeah. Like,
and the feel, they tell you about motor racing, the feel of the noise, you feel it inside. Is that right?
The thumping kind of bass.
It's just the engines. Yeah.
Nothing better than a great sound of V8.
Spoken like a true boy who never grew up despite being older these days. So you were the archetypal golf nut by the sound of it, like many of our readers and listeners. This is the lifestyle they have. If there's a way to cram golf into any kind of a trip away, be it a weekend away, be it a Saturday afternoon where they've got nothing else booked, they'll go and do it. That's still quite a long way from in your 50s deciding, I'll have a crack at Q school. So how good did you get as an amateur? Did you have a handicap or were you a vagabond golfer who wandered around?
I came back to Australia at the end of 1990 and I come back to Gold Coast and I joined a club. The first club I joined was up at Mount Tamborine, nine holes sort of course.
Real golf with real
yeah,
people.
Yeah. And
sneakers,
you know,
no gloves.
Handing bloody 3 cards or something, started of handicap 24 or... And, you know, like I was absolutely loved it, you know, absolutely loved it. Like,
and did you improve quickly?
Well, yeah. I was sort of getting better and better and better. And then I got a good job to drive for Holden, you know, got a good offer.
Racing team, did you?
Yeah.
Peter Brock.
Yeah, well, he wasn't there first year. Like, first year I was there by myself.
Right.
Next year was Wayne Gardner.
Wow.
My teammate.
Well, of course, yes, because he stopped racing the bikes into the car. Yeah. I remember that.
And then Brocky after that.
Well, that's Australian royalty. If you'd driven a car with Shane Warne, that would be the trifecta.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyway, because of, you know, it was a great job. Then I had, you know, when I wasn't racing or doing testing or doing some PR work, then I was practicing and playing golf. And, you know, I got to single figures, and then I got.
Now you're really in trouble.
Yeah. Then I got a little better. I joined a better club in here at Arundel Hills. We just shut down.
No longer with us. That's right.
Yeah, it was real shame. Real shame. And I sort of chipping away at it, and because of Holden being involved in golfing as well.
Yeah, that's right. They were huge. The Holden Scramble, and they had the Holden Young Lions, if I recall. They sponsored all those young players.
Yeah, and they also sponsor Norman.
That's right.
Greg Norman Classic. Then And
the Australian Open, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Australian Open. And therefore, suddenly Holden's flying me all over the country to go play in a pro-am there, playing with the Greg Norman in
You played with Greg Norman? Yeah, whereabouts? Yeah, yeah. And what was that like?
It was, he'll never forget it, and I'll never forget it. We played at the Lakes. Was it the Holden Classic or something? Something like that. Mm-hmm. And in a pro-am, it was obviously Norman, you know, and supposed to be Kerry Packer, and was a managing director's wife of Holden, Juanita Hamel, Bill Hamel, big American, and she was brilliant. She was brilliant. Anyway, she loved golf, and you know, then that and myself, that was the foursomes, but in a kind of last minute. You know, Kerry Packer struck lucky in casino somewhere in Las Vegas or something.
Didn't make it in time.
Then a quick replacement was, the name was Harry Watts.
I remember what happened. Tell the story.
Yeah. And I said, I've got a photo still at home on a first tee, all four of us on a first tee. And anyway, we go to the 13th hole, and then suddenly Harry bloody on the ground. Like he had a massive heart attack.
Yeah.
Massive heart attack.
Right in the middle of the fairway.
Well, like there were 200 people following us. There were doctors among them, immediately started CPR and all that. Couldn't bring him back. Yeah. Like it was very sad, you know, and that's when.
It's awful.
You know, Greg will never forget that. And I can say, well, I could have beat Norman, but we didn't finish, you know.
I had him on the road.
I was just about to deliver the knockout punch. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a hideous thing to happen, isn't it?
It was very sad.
Norman would have been not unexcited to play with you too. He's a speed freak and likes his cars, doesn't he?
Yeah, like he was sort of a good mate with Nigel Mansell.
That's right.
And I think he got Mansell to play in the Open, South Australian Open. Yeah. And
is he a two marker maybe not?
He could play. Yeah. Nigel Mansell could play. Yeah, he's probably one of the bravest from Formula One still alive, you know. All the other brave ones killed themselves, you know. But he was unbelievable in Formula One. And anyway, then Holden's flying me in this, like, flew me to Adelaide. I remember I played with Glenn Joyner because we were sponsored by Bridgestone. We used Bridgestone tyres, and Joyner was
Bridgestone clubs or something.
And they flew me there. I played with Joyner in the pro-am, and that was the first time I met him. And he still remembers because sometimes we get to play together now on a tour, and he still remembers as well.
You must have started to resent having to go to races, Thomas. It's starting to interfere with your golf calendar.
Well, it did, you know. Like I always, you know, kept telling them we should sort of, cut down on testing a little bit.
We're working the cars too hard. That's right.
Play more golf.
And give them the weekend off so I can go.
Yeah, anyway, then, I had lots of free time, and I put lots of time into it, and I should have taken lessons, but
you've not had lessons?
No, not really. Those days, no. I was too bloody stubborn, you know.
You got this far anyway, on your own, didn't you? So you can understand.
When I stopped racing, I was 44. I think my last race was 44. And I started immediately after the job with Porsche. Then I sort of said, I've been bloody racing all my life, doing something, competing, and wouldn't mind to have a crack at this bloody seniors tour. And I gave myself like 5 years to get the handicap down to get better. Then I got to 2 handicap and kind of played to it. And then I have a go at this 2 school. Paid about $2,000 or something entry fee, and went to Camden Lakeside Peter Thompson course with bloody bunkers in the middle of the fairways.
On the other side of a hill, then, you can't even, it just looks like a hill in the fairway. When you get on the other side, you're in a bunker.
I made it. I put 3 rounds together. Like I remember last round, I shot 3 under 69 and finished 2nd behind Krishna Singh.
Yeah.
Then I got on a tour and I thought, watch, that's easy, you know, not a big deal. And
how hard can it be?
Then suddenly you realize, oh, geez, you know, the job's not done, because I had to 5 years in a row I had to finish in a top 60 on a money order.
Keep your card.
And to keep the card. And first year I did it all right. Like second year I did it. And then it was getting harder and harder. And I remember I think it was my last year, I did it on a number by about 170 bucks.
Wow.
Yeah. Then I kept my card forever. I'm sort of very proud of it.
That was,
because I'm not a golfer, I still see myself, I'm a race car driver, but, sometimes
reasonably
I
love
golf.
Game.
I love golf, yeah.
Just to go on a tangent, it reminds me, a poor man can never forget it. Brad Hughes missed out on the 125th spot on the PGA Tour one year by $127.
Yeah, yeah.
And never played the PGA Tour again. Never got back.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's just – it's cruel.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, cruel. Now, I can tell you, it's a sort of different appreciation of looking the blokes. They make it for a living. I play it for fun.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
For enjoyment. Yes. I love it. But the blokes, to make – money out of it, to survive on it.
Pay a mortgage.
Oh, my.
Have a car. And
God, the stress, they go through and all that. I really admire those blokes. And
golf fans don't understand, do we? We when we think of professional golf, we think of Tiger and Rory and Adam and private jets and turn up and play golf and somebody gives you a couple hundred thousand bucks and you go to a corporate day and it's not the case for most people playing professional golf.
It's the case for a bloody top 20 in the world or something. But even on the seniors who are playing now, it is quite competitive now, and lots of good blokes and a few of them try to survive on it. And
that's hard to do.
And it's very difficult. But I really step back and look up to them because it is something Jesus. I tell you, I wouldn't want to go through. Then
most people in your situation who come to the game a bit later in life, particularly if they've got some aptitude for it and they get quite good, even though they've taken it up late and they're better than their friends who've been playing their whole life, most of them will think, "I wish if I'd taken this up years ago, I could have been a pro." Well, you've been a pro now. Do you reckon you could have if you'd found golf at the age of when you left?
Well, yeah.
What do you reckon? Could you have made it?
I don't know. I wouldn't have made it to, probably would have made it to get the card or something, but never would have made it the way I made it in motorsport when I could make a living out of it and survive on that for so many years.
Yeah.
It's, it is definitely one of the hardest sports I ever tried. And because it's so hard,
relentless, isn't it?
You're drawn to it, because you want to, test yourself against the best.
And it's relentless.
The
good shot you just hit means nothing because now you've got to play the next one and it could just as easily be a bad shot.
And actually, going back, something common between motor racing and golf is the confidence.
Uh-huh.
In motor racing, you got a good car that gives you good confidence, that gives you that little extra. In golf, you got to hit 400 good shots to get a confidence, but it only takes one bad shot to lose it very quickly.
All the way back to square one. Do not pass, go, not collect.
Yeah, the confidence, I suppose it's in any sport,
interesting. They're two such different pursuits. I wonder how you got hooked on golf when sort of speed. There's a lot of golfers who are into cars, and I kind of understand that a bit more. There's a kind of a, for a lot of blokes, cars from the time they're little are fascinating, aren't they? Richard Green, I think, owns a bunch of race cars. And Wade Ormsby is a big car guy. Peter Lonard loves his cars. I think he's got a big truck now as well. Those kind of things. That direction you can kind of understand. They've devoted their life to golf and the speed thing would be thrilling. But going the other way, what do you think the appeal was for you from speed to no speed?
it was the challenge of it. Yeah, I would say the challenge. Yeah, and it still remains there. Like every time you go tee up, doesn't matter if it's just in a club competition or if it's in a pro-am or in a bigger tournament. It's the challenge of it.
Yeah.
And that's what I love.
It's the personal challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can't blame the bloody mechanics. You can't blame the car. You can't blame the tires. You can't blame the engine.
Have you got a caddy? You need a caddy. You got to have a caddy to blame.
it's you. Yeah.
All of it. The good and the bad, which is the appeal, isn't it? The highs are really high. When you do something really good, nobody else can take any credit.
Yeah.
You've done that all on your own. And similarly, when you do something really bad. Are you a better player now than when you qualified for the tour, do you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like I get more help now than when I started sort of playing. And in our club, actually today as well, I'm on a range and Ozzy comes over, Ozzy Moore, and, just always, have a look and, that's actually not bad. You should be shooting better. I said, no, because I'm putting bad, I've got yips, and things like that. But he comes, and helps me a little bit and just gives me something to work on. Which is great. I think I'm hitting the ball better than I ever did.
There's a wonderful collegiality amongst professional golfers, isn't there? I think there's a natural respect. Very rare that a fellow professional, if you were to ask them for help, would say no.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All of them would completely say, yeah, sure, let me have a look.
Completely different than in motorsport.
Yeah, of course.
In a motorsport, they have you got 10 drivers, chasing the same sponsor.
Yeah.
And they're backstabbing each other and all that. And, golf is more camaraderie.
It's almost perverse, isn't it, Thomas?
Yeah.
You want to help the other players so that they can be at their best, so that when you beat them, there's a greater sense of pride because you beat them when they were at their best.
Something like that, yeah. And I get, I get lots of help from the fellow professionals, on the tour, all the time. We're on a practice range and the blokes I travel with, Brad Burns, Burns is very good and very knowledgeable, Mark Tickle and Chris Taylor and anyone else on a bloody putting green or Stacey's, maybe you should try this. It's really good. It's really, really nice. Wouldn't happen in motorsport.
No. Well, you all share the same sickness.
They try to break it.
That's exactly right. While you're not looking,
cut the brake lines so that you don't.
What were the strengths of your game that got you to the tour? What was it? What part of your game do you think, given that you've not had lessons, you're self-taught, took up the game at 30, qualified for a professional tour at the age of, you would have been 50, 51?
52.
At the time. It's a fairy tale story in some ways. What do you sort of put it down to?
I probably could chip all right. I think that, chipping saves my ass.
It's a crucial part of the game, isn't it?
Yeah. If I can, at the moment, I used to putt all right, but it comes and goes with the putting.
I think we all know that down, Thomas, that putting is not a skill, is it? It's black magic. That's the truth of it, isn't it?
If I could putt the way I chipped, then I'll probably have a better scores. Yeah.
What do you think happens to putting? I was talking to Charlie Earp this morning about this. I interviewed Charlie this morning, and we were trying to think of a really good or great player whose putting did not ultimately desert them later on in their career. And the only person we could really come up with was Ben Crenshaw. But putting seems to, even the great putters, it does not stay forever, does it?
No, it comes and goes, same as anything with that game. Yeah, I always thought it's only happening to me, but it happens to much, much better players.
You've only got to look at the racks of putters in the pro shop. It's not just you, Thomas, the options that are available.
But I'm not an expert in golf, but watching it, another bloke you're talking about putting, I think it's that Kevin Kisner. Mm-hmm. I always kept saying, just imagine if Adam Scott could putt like Kevin Kisner.
Yeah.
The
most dangerous word in golf, Thomas, if.
If
I'd hit one less shot. If I'd got it out of that bunker. Yeah. If you could drive yourself mad with it. And that would be a lesson that you would have learned playing professionally, I imagine. You can't second guess, can you? You could drive yourself mad at the end of the tournament.
You can't go sort of you know, you're going to make a decision, stick to it. Yeah. You can't say, oh, you should have, would have, you know.
Yeah, that's right. It's particularly in golf, there's just, that's a road to perdition. You mentioned earlier, and we were talking about this before we started recording, this sort of appreciation that you've gained for people who've made a living playing the game for all that time. Talk a little bit for people who've probably not thought about that much. What do you mean by that? What is it that you sort of see that we don't see that makes you think, this is really quite a remarkable thing to have done with a life?
No, because you experience it. You sort of play the same course as those blokes do. You get in the same positions. Then how they deal with it, you know, like it's the golf is very much, you know,
it's almost all in the head,
up there in the head. And more experience you have, then. You know, I still don't think like the top players think. You know, that's where I'm lacking with my decisions. Yeah. You know, like I get to some shots and I come up with something completely stupid.
Then as soon as you hit it, you think, that was the wrong shot. Why would I have done that?
Yeah, but it comes with the experience and all that, and it's just amazing how the people think their way around the golf course. Like I remember once I had a good practice round played with Craig Warren.
Okay,
you know, Craig played well in the Japanese
beautiful
tour,
golf.
And
beautiful.
And I just can't play nine holes, and he kind of talked me through it, you know, and I pick up a lot in a way, you know, but. Then you forget it, you know, because you go back to your all normal, you know, bad decisions. But it was just fantastic, and you know, it's the mental approach. What I can see from the good golfers, the mental approach and their attitude, and their attitude when the thing goes bad, to bloody wipe it out, forget about it, and you know. I'm still bloody steaming over it for the 3 holes later. But they just bang down, press on.
And move on. I think it was Bob Jones who said, did he not, that golf is a game of continually learning the same lessons. You learn the lesson, you have the aha moment, you play beautifully for a couple of holes or for a couple of rounds or for a couple of weeks, and then one day, for no reason at all, you've forgotten it, and you're back to can't play again. It's amazing, isn't it? And I think every golfer listening will be nodding their head furiously saying, that's exactly what it's like. Why can't you just hang on to it and keep it? For you, what does golf mean to you now, Thomas? Obviously, you're playing the tour and there's money to play for and those sorts of things, though you're not doing it for your living. Why do you keep doing it? Because I imagine there must be times when it's incredibly frustrating.
Oh, well, it is frustrating, but it keeps me – keeps me fit, keeps me the motivation to do my stretching and to do my bloody exercises. I'm getting on.
How old are you now?
And I'm 64. I'll be 65 soon.
You can't be. If you look like this at 64, I'm not buying it.
Then, I'll be sick. You know, Tick is making fun out of me. I'll be double dipping with the super seniors, you know, at the end of the year. And, it just keeps me fit and it keeps me going.
That's
like I just always look forward to, like I'll be going on Saturday. I'm going out, going to Adelaide.
Okay,
you know, it's always something to look forward to, and I just can't wait. And lucky enough, I've got very understanding wife. Like she's used to that from my motor racing days when I wasn't at home much, and sometimes she went with me to motor racing, but not very often. And same with golf. Sometimes she comes with me, but very rare. She thinks I'm mad. She's chasing that white ball, you know.
She's glad to be rid of you. She gets the house to herself. She's put up with you and all your nonsense and carry on watching the golf.
Absolutely.
How many events roughly do you play a year?
Well, there are roughly about 80 events. If I play about third, you know, then
anything close to home, and then you'll pick and choose some that you might.
It's hard to get a start as well. I try to play where I get the starts, and it fits around work sometimes as well. Then unfortunately, have to work a little, then
well, you can't rely on golf to make a living, Thomas. No, it'd be madness. Nobody can make a living playing golf.
No, I can't. No,
That's crazy. Well, it's been fabulous to catch up with you. It's an amazing story in so many ways, and I'm sure lots of people who remember you from your car racing days, some might not have realised that you play the tour now. They'll be onto the PGA website looking up your results, which would be fantastic. I must also say a thank you to Parkwood, the club who very generously lent us a room to record the podcast in today, and they didn't have to do that, and that was very kind of them. So thank you, Thomas. It's been great to meet you and really appreciate
that. No, thanks to, you know, to be part of this. It was good. I enjoyed that.
During my research, I discovered you've done some motor racing podcasts. So you're still a somebody in motor racing, so it's nice that you get some recognition in golf as well.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Thank you. Cheers, Rob.
Well, there's lots of professional golfers who like fast cars, but it'd be difficult to imagine many of Thomas's former teammates keeping pace with him on the golf course. Big thanks to Thomas for taking the time to chat, and we wish him all the best on his travels this year. Now, on our next, a very special guest joins John Huggan to talk one of the most successful careers in golf history.
You know, I'm always hesitant to criticize or to talk about the change in the game because I don't want to become that old curmudgeon that sounds like, well, back in 1982, we did, you know, it you don't want to sound that way. But that being said, the skill set that the young player has today is fascinating. It's amazing what they're able to do, the power, but the set of skills that it takes to be a successful tour player or worldwide player now is just a totally different set of skills than we had 30 years ago.
That's President's Cup captain Jim Furyk. Next time on The Thing About Golf.